From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. In the Creekwood community in Wilmington, an area also known as the Inner City, and a place where today it's hard to get pizza delivered or much else because drivers fear the neighborhood, it was here in Creekwood that a little boy lived with his mother and four siblings in the 1970s and 80s. There were extended family members, aunts and uncles, but his single mother raised her five children on her own. Because this boy called Reggie had a flair for academia, he learned easily and got good grades. And then one day in the early 1980s, a local private high school, founded for white students to escape integration, offered Reggie a scholarship. He excelled and became the first black student to graduate from Cape Fear Academy. As salutatorian, he gave a speech at commencement during which former students taunted him. He went on to law school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he was president of his graduating class, and he clerked for the first black North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Henry Fry. He spent the next 3 years at a small law firm in Raleigh. He then went on to the National Office of the American Civil Liberties Union in New York, where he stayed for 15 years. In 2011, Reggie Shuford accepted the post of Executive Director of the Pennsylvania ACLU. This little boy from Creekwood, who ticked multiple boxes for being at risk, forged a successful career, and for decades now has been reaching back to help others. What made the difference for him, and why does he say that the real truth and reconciliation conversation has not yet begun? Let's find out. Reggie Shuford joins me now. Reggie Shuford, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks so much for having me.
So good to have you here. I want to go back to Wilmington during the time that you grew up here and paint the picture, because you've described it as having such deep segregation, racial segregation, social segregation, residential segregation. When do you first remember being aware of that?
I feel like I first experienced it probably when we were being bused as elementary school students to school. So probably age 6 or 7. And I think it just persisted throughout the majority of my time in Wilmington before I moved away to go to school in Chapel Hill. So it was really just part of the fabric of the town, frankly.
And what did that mean in terms of what you understood about white people and how you thought about white people? What, when you were that young, 6 years old, what did they represent to you?
Well, it's really interesting. So you mentioned that, you know, I grew up with a single mother who was deeply religious, very open to everybody. She never impressed upon us any need to be concerned about quote unquote white people or anybody for that matter. But I do recall one thing. I recall as a kid, being bused to these schools that were early in the ages of integration, that if we happened to miss the school bus for any reason, we were told we could not walk to school because we would probably encounter members of the KKK who would do harm to us. So I think my early kind of notion of white people was that some of them at least sought to harm me and probably didn't want to have very much to do with me otherwise.
I want to really understand what it was like as a single mom trying to raise five kids on her own. I mean, in any circumstance, that's difficult, but especially someone who relied on welfare. She worked also, right? She was, but at one point in your childhood, you've said you guys had so little money that sometimes the electric bill wouldn't get paid. And how did you experience that? What happened in your household?
So some of these are difficult kind of memories and to talk about, but they're real. And all of it helped shaped me in terms of who I am today, but also what I chose to do professionally. But so it really starts with my mother as her own singular being, and who was deprived of the opportunity to pursue her own dreams. So before she had children, she had her own life and dreams, and was deeply intelligent, was known as one of the smartest and prettiest girls in her neighborhood, but had a lot of difficulty throughout the entirety of her life, starting in her childhood. It happened that at age 15, she became pregnant and had her first child at a time that did not allow you to continue in school if you became pregnant. So she was forced out of school. And despite being deeply intelligent, never was able to go back and finish her schooling. And as a result of that, really the only job she was allowed to do was to work as a domestic and a housekeeper. So she did that, but supplemented the money that she had from welfare and food stamps and government assistance. So it was a struggle raising five kids. She did it without complaint, but also I think it's a commentary on the ways that our society, certainly Wilmington, did not support people who could have used a hand.
Do you know what her dreams were specifically?
Yeah, she told me that she really just wanted to be like a secretary or an administrative assistant. Like, she was good at spelling. She was good at writing. She loved to write old-fashioned letters. And so it wasn't anything particularly lofty, but it's what she wanted to do. And as a result of not ever being able to fulfill her own dreams, we ended up having very little income in the household. And so there were times where we didn't have sufficient food, or we lost electricity, or we had to wait till dark to go to our neighbors to borrow jugs of water. It was certainly a struggle.
You actually kept empty milk jugs around so that if the water bill went unpaid, you could go to your neighbor and get water for baths or for the toilet?
Yeah, we did. We kept jugs. We went to neighbors, borrowed water. Sometimes we would go to cook food at their house when we didn't have electric or gas to cook on our own stove. But yeah, that was the reality of our growing up with a single mother trying to raise five children.
And so this very smart woman gave birth to at least one, probably more, very smart children. And so I'm talking about, you did well in school. When did you first realize that you were a pretty darn smart guy and a good student?
Well, thanks for asking. I'm laughing because, I think, you know, I was considered smart. It's a little kind of embarrassing to be describing oneself in those terms, but the way that it really came to be was that I was also kind of a bit of a troublemaker. And so I would talk back, you know, because all of the chaos that was happening in our household had to impact me and my other siblings, right? And so in part, I kind of cut up, I talked back, had kind of a chip on my shoulder, and I got sent to the principal's office. And I heard many times, "You're such a smart kid. Like, why won't you behave? Like, why don't you just be quiet? Do your work and just, you know, and not be such a cut up." And so, so I heard it a lot. I don't know that I really believed it until I had some really caring teachers and a guidance counselor who intervened to kind of get me on the right track.
In junior high, there was an instance when you wound up on the honor roll, and you actually had a teacher who was shocked. Was she a white teacher?
It was a white teacher, yes. I remember her very, very well. She was surprised. She was my homeroom teacher and my math teacher. And so when she gave out everybody's report card, she gave me mine. She told me, I'm surprised you made the honor roll. So I never forgot that. I forgave her, but it spurred me on to do a lot better than I had been doing up to that time.
What does it mean you forgave her? What does that mean to you?
Because she was kind of a tough cookie for everybody. And listen, I was talking back, right? So I did have kind of a little attitude. And so she may have been saying, not that I don't think you're intelligent, but that as much as you kind of don't study hard and you cut up, that may have been why she made that comment.
And you got offered a scholarship from Cape Fear Academy back when its school mascot was the rebel, the symbol of the Confederacy. And so I'm going to ask you about how that scholarship came about and when you learned what the rebel actually meant. You're listening to Coastline. Reggie Shuford, Wilmington native and current executive director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, is my guest today. We'll be back from this short break in 90 seconds. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Reggie Shuford grew up in the Creekwood community in the 1970s and 80s in a very segregated Wilmington. But because he was academically gifted, he received one of the first scholarships for Black students to Cape Fear Academy. He went on to become a successful lawyer, and in 2011, he became executive director of Pennsylvania's ACLU. And Reggie Shuford, just before we went to break, I asked you about getting that scholarship to Cape Fear Academy. But first, compare the segregated Wilmington of the 1970s and 80s to segregated Wilmington of 2021. Where are we in comparison?
So, you know, I think I would be lying if I said there hadn't been any progress at all. But honestly speaking, it still feels fairly segregated, at least residentially. So some progress, but a lot more to be made, I think. But, you know, I think there are people there doing really good work to try to make those changes happen. But it still has some ways to go, is my sense.
Yeah. Where do you see the work being done? Where do you see progress being made?
Honestly, in ways that I did not see when I was living there and growing up there, I think a lot of people also take umbrage at kind of the social realities of Wilmington, and they have found many ways to push back. There are folks who work in inner city neighborhoods. There are folks who use art to combat some of the injustices they see. So I see a lot of kind of collaboration from different groups, from different areas and backgrounds doing really important work. So I think when, you know, my sense is that when folks see oppression, many people of goodwill respond to combat it. And I think that's what's happening in Wilmington.
So going back to the early 1980s, Cape Fear Academy offered you one of its first scholarships because one of your friends didn't want to be the only black student there. Tell us about that. First of all, Cape Fear Academy was founded to protect white students from having to integrate.
Yes, it was founded in 1967 as a quote unquote segregation academy, which was designed to avoid integration. And so by the time I got there, I guess 17 years, 16 years after it was founded, I was the first black student, along with my good friend who you asked about. And I was the first black student to graduate in 1984. My understanding is that there had been a black student before we got there, but some of the people who taunted me at my graduation also chased her away and she never returned. So the way that I got the scholarship was through my sister's best friend. They're both 2 years younger than I. So Cece Muldrow was our neighbor across the street and our family friend. And she and my sister were best friends. And Cece was an amazing basketball star as well as a great student. And word of her excellence on the basketball court got generated a lot of publicity, including that Capher Academy. They found out about Cece. They made it known that they would like for her to transfer to Capher Academy. To play basketball for them. And it was all very flattering. Here we are living in Creekwood, this kind of notorious housing project without many means. And although I will say this about Creekwood, it was a very strong family environment. The very same things that my schoolmates in Forest Hills and Pine Valley and at Riceville Beach wanted for their kids, our families wanted for us as well. We just didn't have the resources necessarily to get all those things. And so we were all fairly close-knit. CC was like, okay, I'm interested, I guess, but I certainly don't want to be the only black student there. And they said, well, if you have a friend who's academically gifted, then we can offer that person a scholarship too. Well, bless her heart, it wasn't my sister. She's gifted in many ways. She didn't care as much about academics, I guess, as I did. And I was at New Hanover at the time, really making straight A's and A pluses. And so when CC mentioned it to me, I was like, okay, I'll consider it. We both had to go be interviewed. And so I remember, like, the guidance counselor said, well, we need to ask you about your grades. We need to make sure that you're able to handle the rigors of, like, the school. And they asked me class by class by class what my grades were. And at that point, they literally were all A pluses. And so and so it was a pretty easy interview. And so on the strength of that, Cece and I became Capher Academy's first kind of black students who kind of stayed for a while. And I graduated. She ended up leaving. She was 2 years younger and she ended up leaving and transferring to Laney, but I graduated in 1984.
Do you know why she left?
Ooh, such a good question. To be honest, both of us experienced kind of racial hostility and aggression while we were there. In part from students, but especially from some parents who didn't want their kids to be friends with us or who didn't want them to drive to Creekwood to pick us up for a school activity, who were just not really subtle in some of their, dislike of us. And as hard as I thought I had it, she had it much harder on the basketball court. I was a statistician for the boys and girls varsity basketball team, so I would travel with them on away trips. And she got called the N-word on the basketball court fairly regularly. And so I think, given that experience, given the fact that I had left, and so she was then the only black student there, she wanted a different experience, and so she transferred.
So you endured racial hostility. It's interesting because the way you talk about Cape Fear Academy and the way you talk about Wilmington, you have this kind of very charged, both positively and negatively charged emotional connection with both. And you excelled at Cape Fear Academy, and so you have good memories about the school, but at the same time, there were white students who gave you a really hard time. Did you get called the N-word while you were there?
Oh, yes.
How did
Absolutely.
You, do you remember the first time? How did you deal with it? What did you feel when that first happened?
I was hurt. I was angry. I felt isolated and unsupported. I was mad. I was resolved to not letting anybody ruin my experience. I was going to get out of that experience what I could, which was college preparation, frankly. But I never forgot about it. And by the same token, I would say this, like, so your point about kind of having this complex relationship to Cape Fear Academy and to Wilmington, in some respects, I think Cape Fear Academy was just a microcosm of Wilmington, frankly, the racial dynamics, et cetera. Because there were many positive things as well. There were people who I became friends with, who are friends to this day. There are people I could talk to about some of those experiences and who were likewise outraged on my behalf. There were some teachers who clearly cared about me and my well-being and made it known that they were friends and supportive. So it wasn't all bad. It was challenging, but there was also a lot of support in many ways as well, which is why I have kind of a mixed, complicated, nuanced recollection of that experience.
You resolved, even before Cape Fear Academy, when you were pretty little, that you were going to be a lawyer. And so it sounds like this sense of a desire for making justice and a level playing field and opportunities available for everyone. It sounds like that was kind of instilled in you way before some of these experiences. Can you talk about just going back to your mom and how her life made you feel that you wanted to kind of help her, people like her?
Sure. I was a mama's boy, so I wanted to be well behaved for her, but I also wanted to make her life easier and the lives of people who were kind of like her easier as well. And that included many of my relatives. But I had even as a small kid, I had a visceral reaction to injustice of any kind. And even in the moment, I would try to make things right, even in my own limited little 5-year-old, 6-year-old way. The way I decided to become a lawyer was I was very inquisitive. And so whenever people would visit us, I would ask them all types of questions about do they have sisters and brothers? Do you get along with them? Do you like to read? What's your favorite color? So more than one time, one of them said, "Slow down, kid, you sound like a lawyer." And so I made a decision at age 5 that, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I didn't know what lawyers were. Again, I'm the first person in my family to graduate from high school, so I certainly didn't know any lawyers, didn't have any role models at hand. But as I got older and reacted in my visceral way to the injustices that I experienced myself and my family and my friends and my mother and others, I learned that there are different types of law that I could specialize in. And so civil rights law was one of those things. And that's why I decided very early on that that's what I would do.
So this little boy from Creekwood who had multiple reasons why he could have fallen through the cracks and gone down a completely different path, you managed to forge this incredibly successful career. Now you're reaching back to help others. Why do you think that you managed to avoid a pitfall that would have been really understandable given your circumstances?
I think there are probably a number of reasons. I think I was quiet and shy. And so rather than kind of being out and about, I would prefer to be home reading a book. So reading gave me glimpses into other possibilities and realities and other worlds that I ultimately aspired to. So that was one thing. The other thing is I had people in my life who encouraged me and supported me and who intervened at just the right moment. So as I mentioned before about kind of being a cut up, I got sent to a guidance counselor's office. And at one point she said, you know, you're really smart. So despite all of this trouble you're getting in, I think it might be that you're bored and you need to be challenged more or differently. She said, I'm going to take a chance on you. It was a Black guidance counselor, Ms. Williams. She said, I want to have you placed in academically gifted and see if that changes things. And that expression of faith in me really made all the difference in the world. Like, I did not want to let her down. And so it was almost like a light switch went off. Like, I no longer needed to cut up or talk back or act out. I devoted all of my energies in trying to be a really, really good student. And at that point, I became that and kind of never looked back.
Now, you've been back to Cape Fear Academy. And, you know, as we said earlier, you have this complicated relationship. You remember being bullied by partly through racial slurs. And because you were Black, you were bullied. And you actually had an opportunity as a successful adult to confront some of the people who bullied you. What was that like? What was that conversation like?
You know, it was cathartic is the word that comes to mind, because I've lived with this for a long time. I've learned that bullies bully other people for different reasons, and themselves probably have had challenging childhoods. There was this kind of group of folks who all were in the same class, who actually graduated before I got there, but when they came home to school events, like I would see them, and they made it clear they were just not interested in me being there still. So the school celebrated its 50th anniversary in 2017. And I went because it's home. It gave me a chance to visit Wilmington. I knew that there would be some friends there I could see. And so one of those guys who had been part of this group of bullies came up to me and was like, I'm very proud of you and your career and all that you've achieved. And I was like, that is very interesting, because that is not the experience that we had when I was attending Cape Fear Academy in high school. You made
why
it clear
did, why
that.
Did, why did you go there? I mean, because in that moment, that was a choice. In that moment, you could have said, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and moved on. But you chose to go back and say, this was my experience. Yeah, so sorry, continue the story, but why?
Right, because I think every kid who has been bullied imagines at some point confronting their bully. And I wasn't going to let this opportunity slip away, number one. And then number two, I didn't want to be complicit in revisionist history that underserved me. I wasn't interested in indulging somebody else's revisionist history in a way that didn't serve me well. And I just didn't want to do that. And so I confronted him on it, and he actually apologized. So it was worth it. I mean, I think truth, no matter how difficult, is always the better option. And I preferred to have our conversation be based in truth, even if it was a reality that he conveniently forgot or did not want to remember. I thought it was my obligation to myself until 16, 17-year-old Reggie, right, to to stand up, right? In a way that I felt like I did, wasn't empowered to do then, I certainly feel empowered to do now. And so I did that. And that's what I do for a living. Like I empower other people to use their voices. And so it would have been hypocritical of me not to do the same for myself.
How did he react? I mean, you said he apologized. Do you feel like it was a sincere apology? Was he embarrassed? What was his reaction?
So first he was surprised, but he listened. And so secondly, he did apologize. And I think he was ashamed and embarrassed. So I think I'd like to think that the exchange was helpful for both me and for him. And I think people can change. And maybe he has changed. Some of his classmates did not, because I had another experience just last year, but with a different one. But maybe he's changed. In any case, I think it was a good conversation, a short one, but an important one.
Yeah. And I also want to hear about you, because you still have family here and you consider Wilmington your hometown. You visit frequently, and you had an experience as an adult with the police here that we're going to hear about when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. Pennsylvania ACLU Executive Director Reggie Shuford is my guest today. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Growing up in Wilmington, Reggie Shuford lived with his single mother and four siblings. They sometimes ate by candlelight when his mother couldn't pay the electric bill, and borrowed water in empty milk jugs when the water bill didn't get paid. When they moved into the housing project known as Creekwood, they felt as though it was a step up. But as young as age 6, Reggie says he knew he wanted to be a lawyer, and he knew he wanted to spend his life helping people who were victims of an unfair and racist system. Today, Reggie Shuford is executive director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, and he still visits his hometown Wilmington regularly, including staying at Carolina Beach. Reggie Shuford, just before we went to break, I promised we'd talk about an encounter that you had with Wilmington police as an adult. You were a lawyer at this point. You were back in Wilmington visiting. Tell us what happened that day you were on your cell phone during a break in a board meeting.
Sure. I've actually written a number of blogs about my experiences in Wilmington. And this particular one, this particular experience gave rise to one that I called Home Not So Sweet Home. And it's because almost invariably when I visit home, I have an experience that reminds me of the racial tensions in the city, frankly. So on this occasion, I was home for a meeting because I served as chair of the board of a national nonprofit organization called Working Films that just happens to be based in Wilmington. And so whenever we had meetings, it gave me the opportunity to visit home as well as attend those meetings. And so I had been on the board for many years. I had been chair for a number of years, and I thought that it was time to pass that torch. And the person that I and a couple of other people had in mind was not able to make that meeting because she was doing college tours with her son. And so I took a break from the meeting that was in a house near New Hanover High School, where I went to high school before I went to Kafer Academy. I took a break from the meeting. It was probably 10:30, 11 in the morning, of kind of a bright, sunny fall day. And I went outside to talk to her, to try to encourage her to, you know, take over for me as board president. And so we were talking, and as I talk on the phone, I'm a pacer. And after a couple of minutes, I noticed a police car pull up, and an officer got out, a white officer, and just started staring at me. And then he approached me and asked me what I was doing. And I was like, I'm on a phone call talking to a colleague. He said he had a report of somebody suspicious. And I was like, I'm just on a call, like on a public street, like there's nothing nefarious going on. And I said, and if you're done, I'm going to continue on my merry way. I could tell that he wasn't happy about that. And again, and when I told him who I was and what I was doing, he said, how do I know that to be true? I was like, well, because I just told you, and I don't have any reason to lie about it. Then I said, but if you're asking me for my driver's license to prove who I am, then, you know, the answer is no. Because as a lawyer, I know that I'm not required to do that. I might do it if you ask nicely in a way to kind of make sure that this situation doesn't escalate. But otherwise, I know that I don't have to, and so I'm not going to. And so if we're done, I'm going to continue. And I said those things pretty calmly, although I was nervous, I was agitated, I was a bit on edge, and I was angry.
And why were you feeling those things? I mean, the anger, we understand, because you are within your rights to not identify yourself since you weren't doing anything illegal. But in terms
of... Or to be stopped, right? I was in... Right. So that's part of the anger too. Like, why are you stopping me? Yeah.
Right. But why the agitation? Why the fear? What was going on in your mind at that point?
Well, because even at that point, there had been a number of incidents around the country in which those encounters ended in the death of Black people who similarly had not been doing anything wrong or illegal, and they ended up dead. So I was agitated because I knew that this could escalate out of control. I was nervous and kind of fearful for those very same reasons, right? Who knows how this might end up? And then finally, I have far too many relatives and friends in Wilmington to name who have been brutalized and targeted by the police, by the Wilmington Police Department.
In what ways have they been brutal? I mean, we've seen cell phone video from other places around the country. We've heard the stories and we've seen some of that evidence. But in Wilmington, which is now, by the way, helmed by the first Black police chief in the department's history.
I think he grew up in Creekwood too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I think you're right about that. Yes.
We're proud of him. We were neighbors. We lived across the street from each other.
Did you knew him?
Yeah. He was a couple years younger than me. If I have the right, he may have a twin brother. I'm trying to remember. But I think we grew up across the street from each other. He was a couple years younger than me. And again, that just goes to show you that in Creekwood and every other housing project, parents want the same for their kids. People have the same goals and aspirations. We just have fewer resources often to achieve them. But anyway, you were asking another question.
Yeah. So going back to some of the stories that you heard from friends and relatives, you use the word brutalized and targeted. Exactly how? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, I have cousins who talk about being chased by the police, being followed by them, being accosted by them, being thrown to the ground, being arrested by them, only to have no charges be filed at all because they hadn't done anything wrong. But just this kind of repeated, it sounds like they were being terrorized. Like some of them were legitimately being terrorized because they were being closely surveilled and scrutinized by the police, even when they hadn't done anything wrong, close to home. And, you know, I haven't heard about that in the last 2 or 3 years, but it hasn't been that long ago that, and then relatedly, when this situation happened to me, I explained a little bit of it on social media, but I got calls from friends and family who said to me, Reggie, you're the one to go public with this, because given who you are as a racial profiling expert nationally and internationally, as a lawyer, they'll probably finally listen to you. This stuff happens to us all of the time, but they don't listen to us. So we need you to go public. And I didn't really go public in that moment because I felt so many things, shame and humiliation and anger and whatever. It took me a year or two to finally put it to paper. And so I wrote about it. But yeah, it was a constant feature of growing up in Wilmington to be targeted and surveilled and mistreated by the police. And sometimes it was physical brutality. Other times it was kind of the mental kind of terror of not knowing what the encounter might turn out to be. But it was a constant feature.
Isn't it ironic or perfect that you are an expert in racial profiling? You've brought action against victims of racial profiling. So as a lawyer, why didn't you bring action against the Wilmington Police Department for that?
That is such a good question. I will tell you that a number of friends disagreed with my decision not to file a lawsuit, in part because I think I have a sense of scale, and I, in the overall scheme of things, walked away feeling humiliated but not harmed. And I thought, do I really want to get involved in an expensive, years-long battle that frankly most often don't end in accountability? The police often police their own, and they do so in a way that rarely ends in accountability. And do I really want to get engaged in that at this? And I thought, living in Philadelphia, this being in North Carolina, I would have to maybe travel. And I just didn't have any confidence that the outcome would be worthwhile. And so I thought, well, even if I don't file a case, what I can do, right, what is part of my arsenal as an activist and an advocate and a lawyer is to employ strategies other than litigation. Public shaming and social media and organizing and all of those things. So there are ways to address these situations short of filing a case. And I decided that what I would do would be to talk about my experience, write it up and share it on social media, do a blog, and then have conversations very much like the one we're having now.
Okay, truth and reconciliation conversations. This is something you've said hasn't really even begun. Now, there have been conversations about race and between white people and people of color in Wilmington for decades. Those conversations have gone on in different forms. It sounds like you don't think that we've really made progress. And what is a conversation about truth? How do we do that so that we know we're having it?
Ooh, important question. And so here's some context for what I mean, particularly with respect to Wilmington, I would say. I was an adult living in New York City, probably in my 30s at the time, maybe early 40s, I don't know. When I first learned of the Wilmington Massacre of 1898. Never a word about it for the entirety of my time there. That is the truth of Wilmington, North Carolina. And we don't have a lot of conversations about that. In fact, there's been a conspiracy of silence around that history, so that I and virtually any other Wilmingtonian rarely learned about this or ever talked about it. We don't talk about these things enough. There have been some conversations, but not with the fullness that is required, in my opinion, to constitute truth. We need to know the good, the bad, the ugly in an unvarnished fashion. People will be uncomfortable, and that's okay. But people need to take accountability for, they need to know what really happened, they need to talk about what really happened, and they need to take accountability for it. For me, truth is having those difficult conversations, and reconciliation is taking accountability for it in order to really be able to move on and have Wilmington be the place that it used to be. Never perfect, but much better in terms of interracial friendships and collaboration and even running the city and the municipal government. That's what I mean by truth, really getting to the bottom of what really happened, all of it, and then being able to take some accountability for it in order to move on to a better place.
Do you think it's progress when a park that had been named Humacrae Park for many years gets renamed to Longleaf Park? And of course, Humacrae was one of the masterminds of the 1898 coup d'etat to which you referred. But is that progress? And what would you say to people who argue against that strategy and say, what are you going to do, rewrite all of history and rename everything? I mean, Market Street, you've pointed out, was named for the antebellum slave market. And it's one of the main thoroughfares in Wilmington. What do you say to people who say you can't just go back and rewrite everything and erase it all?
So I say a couple of things. Number one, yes, there is progress at Humacrae Park was renamed. Meg McCrae was my class schoolmate, a couple of years younger, at Cape Fear Academy. There are other people affiliated at Cape Fear Academy whose ancestors were involved in 1898. And this is not about renaming everything. This is not about rewriting history. It's about acknowledging history and talking about it and accepting the truth of it. And if there's a consensus through reconciliation that renaming at least some places is important, then so be it. There are many, many people of goodwill who have not done things that we think are unacceptable in terms of race, who deserve to have a statue or a street named after them or a development named after them. There are many good people to choose from.
And so you're saying the truth part has to come before the reconciliation part. And it's the truth part that will inform how the reconciliation unfolds. But one has to come before the other.
Yes, I say that, Rachel, all the time. And that's exactly how I feel. I think it's exactly right. And I have to admit, like I got that concept of one necessarily coming before the other through Bryan Stevenson, who's a noted civil rights lawyer and who created the anti-lynching museum and the lynching museum in Montgomery and the legacy. Yeah, so I don't know if you know
the Equal Justice Initiative. Yes.
Yeah, that's one of the things he does. But he also came up with this lynching memorial and this legacy museum also in Montgomery. And he says, and he talks about these issues, that all of that history needs to be fully discussed, the truth of it known, before you can have reconciliation.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Reggie Shuford, Executive Director of Pennsylvania ACLU, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Rachel. It was such an honor.
Thanks also to Coastline producer Rachel Keith, Technical Director Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media.